Today on the Sunday edition of Renewing Your Mind.
In the trance, Peter sees this cloth descending from heaven, and in it, he sees all kinds of four-footed animals of the earth, wild beasts, creeping things, birds of the sky, and he hears a voice. Rise, Peter, kill and eat.
We come to a critically important passage of Scripture today in our study in the book of Acts. Thanks for joining us here on Renewing Your Mind. I'm Lee Webb. Dr. R.C. Sproul has been taking us verse by verse through the book of Acts over the past several weeks. And as we turn to the 10th chapter today, we'll learn about the vision from heaven that came to Peter. It's a rather mysterious passage. God told him to rise and eat unclean animals. Does that mean that God changed his mind about the Mosaic Law? And does it mean that he'll change his mind in the future? Dr. Sproul helps us understand this passage today in his sermon delivered at St. Andrew's Chapel in Sanford, Florida.
We've come now to the 10th chapter of the book of Acts. And I have to say to you that I believe that this chapter, chapter 10, is one of the most important chapters of the entire book of Acts, if not the most important chapter. And I would also add to that, that this chapter, in my judgment, is one of the most important chapters that we find anywhere in the New Testament, because it brings to our attention an extremely important moment in redemptive history, a time of transition from the old way of doing things to a whole new epoch of redemptive activity by God. And to understand that, before I look at the text itself, let me digress for just a moment and read a portion of Paul's letter to the church at Colossae, to the Colossian community, where he writes the following words in the first chapter of that epistle, beginning at verse 24. Paul says this, "I now rejoice in my sufferings for you, and I fill up in my flesh what is lacking in the afflictions of Christ for the sake of his body, which is the church, of which I became a minister according to the stewardship from God which was given to me for you to fulfill the word of God, the mystery which has been hidden from ages and from generations but now has been revealed to his saints. To them God willed to make known what are the riches of the glory of this mystery among the Gentiles, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory." What Paul is saying to this congregation that is made up of Gentiles is this. He's rehearsing his own credentials. He says, "I am afflicted at every side, and yet I'm rejoicing in my sufferings because you are benefiting from them. I'm filling up that which is left unfinished in the sufferings of Christ himself, in the apostolic ministry that he's called me to perform among the Gentiles. And what I have been called to do now is to reveal to you a mystery that has been hidden for ages and ages and generations of generations. I'm going to tell you something, explain something to you, open up something to you that has been obscured for centuries. I'm going to explain the mystery." The Greek word there is mysterion. We get the word mystery from mystery novels and suspense dramas and all of that from this. But in the New Testament sense, what a mystery is something that God had held back in times past of his disclosure of his purposes, which he at a certain point in history then declares openly. It once was hidden, but now is made manifest. And what is that mystery? He said, it's the mystery of the church, of the Gentiles in the church, that you, Gentiles, who had been strangers to the covenant of the things of God, You who were foreigners, you who were pilgrims, who were kept outside of the inner sanctuary of Israel. You who formerly were unclean and defiled and had no access into the presence of God. Now I'm declaring to you that through the ministry of Christ, that you are a part of his body, the church, that it is Christ in you, the hope of Gentiles. That's the mystery. In previous generations, it was assumed that for the Gentile who was unclean, who was defiled, impure, not consecrated, outside the scope of the covenant God had made with Abraham and Moses and so on, that that person was without hope. But now, with the presence of Christ breaking down the barriers that had separated Jew and Gentile, that hope is extended to the Gentiles. Now, I'm looking at least one person right now who is Jewish by origin and ethnic background, who is now a Christian, a member of this body. But I suspect that almost everybody else in this room is of Gentile background. And the only reason we're here this morning is because of what takes place in Cornelius' household at Caesarea that we've read about here in Acts chapter 10. So let's go to that text and see if we can discern what's going on here, and what is its significance for us even today. If you remember last week, we ended up the chapter 9 with a sort of a postscript, almost a dangling postscript at the end, where an offhand comment by Luke saying that Peter remained for a while in Joppa, and he was staying at the home of Simon the tanner, which should have been a little bit of a clue of what was coming next, because a tanner was somebody who, in order to tan the hides of animals, had to be busy with the carcasses of dead animals, which was a taboo to a pious Jew. So in all probability, this Simon, with whom Peter stayed in Joppa, was a Gentile who was considered unclean. But they also made a distinction among the Jews. It was one thing for a Jew to welcome a Gentile into his house. It was quite another to go into the home of the Gentile, because that was considered unclean. And so we pick it up with verse 1 of chapter 10 that reads as follows. There was a certain man in Caesarea. Remember your map. Caesarea is just a little bit north on the coast, the Mediterranean coast, just above Joppa. And this man was called Cornelius. He was a centurion, and usually centurions were captains over 100 men in the Roman armies. But sometimes that term centurion was used not only to refer to that person who had the rank of command over 100, but also could be used to someone who was more or less a graduate-level centurion, one who was a higher officer in the military, and it seems to be the case here with Cornelius because he was of the elite guard of the emperor of the Italian regiment. So you might have here a Delta Force, Army Ranger, Navy SEAL, whatever, with a high command. But anyway, he was a man who was a big man in Caesar's army. And so we read that this Cornelius is described as a devout man and one who feared God. Now, let me stop there for a second. Remember, when we started the book of Acts, I mentioned to you that the book of Acts follows the Great Commission, where Jesus gave his disciples the responsibility of preaching the gospel first in Jerusalem, then to Judea, then to Samaria, and then to the uttermost parts of the earth. And so the book follows that progress of the church opening in Jerusalem, expanding then into Judea, out to Samaria, and then out to the uttermost parts of the earth with Paul's missionary journeys. And also the book of Acts has to do with four distinct groups of people: the Jews, the Samaritans, the Gentiles, and the God-fearers. Now, who are the God-fearers? The God-fearers were those Gentiles, Greek-speaking Gentiles usually, who converted to Judaism in every respect except one. They did not subject themselves to circumcision for obvious reasons. One thing to be circumcised as an infant, another thing as a grown man. And the men said, hey, you know, we'll be happy to just be out in the court of the Gentiles. We'll take our vows and we'll practice Judaism, but no thanks on the circumcision. So that's where they were, and they were called the God-fearers because even though they were Gentiles, they didn't believe in the gods and goddesses of Rome or the pantheon of deities of Greece or any of the Oriental religions of the day, but rather they believed in the Most High God and were faithful followers of Yahweh, the God of Israel. Now that's where Cornelius was in his faith, and that's what's his status as he's defined here by Luke as a God-fearer, one who feared God as well as all of his household, who gave alms generously to the people and prayed to God always. Now what happens is about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, suddenly Cornelius has a vision of an angel who appears to him and speaks to him, saying, Cornelius. And when he saw this angel and heard the voice addressing him, he's terrified, as in anybody would be. You would be if an angel appeared to you and spoke to you as a representative messenger from God himself. And this angel appears in the middle of the afternoon and says, Cornelius. And he answers and he says, what is it, Lord? Remember Paul's response on the road to Damascus when Christ appeared to him and spoke to him in Hebrew saying, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And Saul was struck blind. He's on the ground and he cries out, who is it, Lord? He didn't know who it was, but he knew it was his Lord. And so in like manner now, Cornelius knows it's the Lord speaking to him, but he doesn't have a clue why. What is it? What's it all about? So the angel said to him, your prayers and your alms have come up for a memorial before God. I don't want to just pass over that. Because for the Jewish people who did have access to the inner court of the temple and brought their sacrifices, the smoke from the burnt offerings, as well as the incense from the altar of incense, or which is the altar of prayer, wafted into the air. The smoke was lifted heavenward, symbolizing a sweet aroma to God. And what the angel says to Cornelius, even though you're not a Jew, Cornelius, your prayers and your sacrifices have been sweet as they have come heavenward to God. And God is recognizing you. God is noticing you. So listen to what I want you to do. Send men to Joppa. Do it now. Send for Simon, whose surname is Peter. He's lodging with Simon, a tanner, whose house is by the sea. And he'll tell you what you must do. And then when the angel who spoke to him had departed, Cornelius called two of his household servants and a devout soldier from among those who waited on him continually, his military aid, as it were. And when he explained all these things to them, he sent them on to Joppa. Those were the instructions, and God gave specific directions, not only what city to go to, but to what house to go, and where it was by the sea. You go to Simon the tanner's house, and you find Peter, Simon Peter, and tell him to come here. So then we read that the next day, as they were on their journey, they're on their way to Joppa, and drew near the city. In the meantime, Peter went up on his housetop to pray in the housetop of Simon the tanner about the sixth hour, about the same time about the sixth hour. This is about noon, actually. And he became very hungry, and he wanted to eat. So the servants began to make a meal, to prepare a meal for Simon Peter. But while they were making it, Simon fell into a trance. And in this trance, he saw heaven opened and an object like a great sheet. That descriptive term there for the great sheet is also the same term that can be used for a huge sail on a sailing ship. And so this huge piece of cloth, in the trance, Peter sees this cloth descending from heaven, and all of its four corners are bound together because it's bringing this huge bundle of things from heaven down to the earth. And so Peter's looking at this in the vision, and in it he sees all kinds of four-footed animals of the earth, wild beasts, creeping things, birds of the sky, and he hears a voice. And the voice says, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." Get up and kill these animals and eat them. Now remember what Saul said in the road to Damascus. "Who is it, Lord?" What Cornelius said when the angel came to him, "What is it, Lord?" What does St. Peter say when God tells him to rise, kill, and eat? Listen to these two words. Put them together and see if you can make any sense out of them. "No, Lord." What could be more insane than if God Almighty tells you to do something and you acknowledge his lordship and his sovereignty over your life and you say, "Thank you very much, but no, I'm not going to do that." This is part of the reason that Peter has this reputation for impetuosity from time to time. Here God speaks to him out of the blue, and his answer is, "No, not me, not going to do it." And he explains why. Listen to what he says. "No, Lord, for I have never eaten anything common or unclean. I've been a Jew since my birth. I've been an Orthodox Jew. I have kept kosher, never had a piece of bacon, never enjoyed the Jewish dilemma of free ham, never had that experience. I have never broken the dietary laws in my entire life, and I'm not going to start now." So God says, "Oh, okay, well, maybe I came to the wrong address. Maybe I just had a brain cramp for a moment there, and maybe we'll suggest another course of action." No, 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 no. God listens to the protest from Peter, and he says to him, "Peter, what God has cleansed, you must not call common." Now, in this moment, centuries of dietary law and legal requirements that God had sent to his people through Moses are now instantly repealed, abrogated, set aside. Those laws that were so important for the Old Testament Jew to keep. You remember the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace? Why were they in there? Why was Daniel in the lion's den? Because these men in captivity in Babylon, trying to sing the Lord's song in a strange land, still were keeping kosher, and they refused to bow down and worship the king, and they refused to eat the king's food because they wanted to be faithful to the law of God. And they put their lives on the line for it. But now all of a sudden, God changes the rules in the middle of the game. Now that may sound whimsical or capricious to you about the character of God, that maybe God is arbitrary. But we have to understand that when God legislates to his people in the Old Testament, he legislates two different ways. On the one hand, he gives his law that comes out of his own character, that for him ever to repeal it would be for him to do violence to his own sanctity and to his own holiness. If you look at the moral law of the Decalogue of the Ten Commandments that we read here almost every Sunday, there's nothing that could happen and transpire in human history that would suddenly make it okay for God to say to his people, "All right, now you can have other gods before me. Now it's okay for you to believe in anybody you want to believe in." Because for God to do that would be to deny his own character. And if God wouldn't come to the second commandment and say, okay, for centuries and all since from the beginning, it's been blasphemous for me to see you people bowing down and worship idols, but now go ahead, craft some idols for yourself and have a good time. Or, I have said that you shall not ever, ever take my name in vain. I don't ever want to hear my name blasphemed from your mouth, ever, under any circumstances. And I know my son, when he taught his disciples how to pray, and he told them what to pray for, the first thing he told them was, the first petition is, hallowed be thy name. Oh, that people would treat the name of God with such reverence and respect that they would never, ever think of using it in a flippant manner. But now it's okay. Times have changed. It's okay in American television. God says, it's okay with me now. Because I'm not holy anymore. No. Those laws that are based on God's character are without repeal, ladies and gentlemen. They remain forever. There will never be a time, now or ever, when it'd be okay with God for us to blaspheme his name. Yet there are other rules that he set down, not simply because of his unique character, but rather because of his historical purposes. He created a nation, a tiny nation out of the world of Jews, not because they were any better than anybody else, but he said, I'm going to make a holy people. And he calls Abraham out of paganism. And Abraham had not done anything to deserve that. And God said to Abraham, I'm going to bless you. Why? To be a blessing to all the nations of the world. See, my reason for calling this little group of people together, how odd of God it said to choose the Jews. But he didn't choose them and establish this wall around them and give them special rituals and sacrifices and diets and all of that so that they could enjoy that unique position before God among all peoples in the world forever. They were called for this for a purpose, to be a holy priesthood to the world. But after a while, they began to think that this ethnic separation was the end of it. And all you had to do to be saved is to be circumcised. All you had to do to be saved is to be born Jewish. And there was no hope for the God-forsaken, unclean, filthy Gentiles. And so to maintain their purity and their identity of ethnic separation, the dietary laws were added to the covenant until the coming of Christ, who tears down the wall of separation, changes everything, and builds his church, not just with Jews, but with Samaritans, with Gentiles, with God-fearers. And so he says to Peter, the dietary laws have changed. You can eat pork. Peter's like, I can't handle this. It's too much. That stuff's unclean. But you see, what it's about here, people, is not about food or animals. It's about people. Because where this text is going in the rest of the chapter is to show the reason why God repealed the dietary laws is because now those who were unclean are being gathered together and are being made clean by Christ.
Making clean the unclean. What an incredible act of mercy and grace. Thanks for listening to Renewing Your Mind as we continue Dr. R.C. Sproul's sermon series in the book of Acts. His explanation of Peter's vision today was so helpful. The Jews were no longer to consider the Gentiles unclean. All nations and people could be made clean by the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. When Jesus referred to the process of being made clean, he used the phrase, born again. What does that mean? Well, Dr. Sproul has written a helpful booklet called, What Does It Mean to Be Born Again? He explains what the new birth is and tells us why it's necessary. For your gift of any amount today, we would like to send you two copies of this booklet, one for you and one for a family member or a friend. Request it when you call us at 800-435-4343 or when you go online to renewingyourmind.org. This booklet is part of our Crucial Questions series, more than two dozen booklets that answer common questions about the Christian faith. Some of the other titles include, Who is Jesus? What is faith? And Can I Be Sure I'm Saved? This series will provide you with helpful answers to these and other questions. Again, for your gift of any amount, we'll send you two copies of What Does It Mean to Be Born Again? Our number again is 800-435-4343, and our web address is renewingyourmind.org. Next weekend, Dr. Sproul continues his study of Acts chapter 10. Peter refused to eat the unclean food that God proclaimed edible. Peter is about to be tested again, this time by a family of Gentiles. Join us again next Sunday for Renewing Your Mind.